Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. I guess I should say welcome back to the second hour of the program. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for our program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frain, is at the controls. In this second hour of the show, we'll be talking about immigration and how immigration has been affected by concerns over security in the wake of 9/11. And our guest is Edward Alden. He is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's also a former Washington bureau chief for the Financial Times. And he's the author of a book that has come out recently. The title of his book is The Closing of the American Border, Terrorism, Immigration and Security Since 9/11. Harper is the publisher on the book. And in the book, he writes about how 9/11 has affected the openness, the former openness of this country. And certainly he makes the observation that before 9/11, the United States was the most open country in the world. Well, certainly that since has changed. And it's changed because the administration has decided to use immigration enforcement as a way to try to get at the security issues, something that our guest, Edward Alden, says just doesn't work. He says immigration and worries about terrorism, these are two different things and need to be approached in different ways. And he argues that what has happened is, since we've taken this approach, that yes, in fact, perhaps we've found a lot of people here who were here in the United States illegally, but we haven't found any terrorists. And furthermore, he says that what has happened is that these concerns about security and terrorism have made it more difficult for people who want to come to the United States to do that, and that that in the long run is not good for this country because it denies us the expertise, the hard work, everything that immigrants can contribute to the country. So we'll talk in greater detail about this in this hour of the show, and would, of course, take questions from people who are listening. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, you have questions and comments. You are certainly welcome to call. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to keep their comments brief, just so we can keep moving along and get in as many different callers as possible. Mr. Alden, hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me on the show today.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it. Yes, it seems here, again, to sort of restate what I said, it seems that your bottom line here is that as a result of 9/11, immigration and concerns about terrorism have become tangled up together, and that we did indeed, that the administration did choose to take this immigration enforcement approach to dealing with the terrorism issue. And it seems that your bottom line is here, as I said, it's these are two different things and require two different solutions, and that this is just not the way to go.
I mean, I think that is an accurate reflection of the bottom line of the book, though a lot of what I try to do in the book is tell the story of the post 9/11 events, how it was that officials in the Bush administration decided to go down this road. I mean, it was not an unreasonable, irrational set of decisions under the circumstances that we face post 9/11. It wasn't particularly surprising, in fact, that the government turned to immigration laws as a counter-terrorism tool. I think, unfortunately, however, the way in which it was done has hurt our interests as a country in some fairly substantial ways. So the book is you know, even though I think what you're reflecting there is accurate, that is the bottom line that I come away with. The book is more a story than it is an argument. It tries to tell the story of how events played out after 9/11 and how people inside the government made decisions, often under very difficult circumstances, in which they were persuaded that another attack was likely and that they needed to do some pretty dramatic things to make sure that didn't happen.
Well, I think that one of the things that you point out is that immediately after 9/11, right after the attacks took place, I think that people were forced to deal with something that actually had been true for some time, and that is, in spite of all of the requirements that we had about trying to keep track of who was in the United States, who we let in, under what circumstances, that in fact that all was a system that really functioned very poorly, that it was very difficult to exactly keep track of who is here, when they came, when they left, what were they allowed to be doing, how many people were overstaying their visas, where they were, that in fact it was a very porous kind of system to start with.
Absolutely, no question. I mean, we knew almost nothing about people who are here in the country, particularly non-immigrants. I mean, people who had gone through the legal immigration system, we had basic information about. But there are, and continue to be, an awful lot of people living in the United States under a temporary status of one form or another, as students or visitors or people coming to do business. And that's, you know, not even to take into account people who are not authorized to be here. So you see people who've overstayed their visas or people who crossed the borders illegally in the first place. And so, you know, before 9/11, this had been a nuisance, and every now and then there had been energetic debates about illegal immigration and its impact, but suddenly after 9/11, the thought was, well, you know, there might be further terrorist cells in the United States, and we have no idea where they might be or how to go about looking for them. So the problem became far more urgent post 9/11 than it had been prior to 9/11. Mm-hmm.
And probably if 9/11 hadn't occurred, that probably, well, we wouldn't be having this conversation. Probably these kind of changes that we'll talk about wouldn't have happened.
I think most of them wouldn't have. I mean, we had already seen in the 1990s, you know, considerable fortification of the southern border to try to discourage illegal immigration and to a lesser extent drug smuggling. And I think that would have continued, though probably at a slower pace than what we saw in the 1990s. But most of the other measures I write about, the toughening of visa procedures, the fingerprinting of visitors who come to the United States, the copious information that travelers to the United States now have to provide, the detailed background checks that are done on students who come to the United States, none of that would have happened without 9/11. Mm.
And certainly we would still probably, as you say, have the kinds of conversation that we're having now that has to do with the issue of illegal immigration, particularly on our southern border, for people who are coming here to the United States for economic reasons. They're coming here because they're hoping to work. And that, you know, that certainly is an issue. Now, though, has that concern, people who are economic immigrants who are coming here illegally, gotten all tangled up here with the terrorism issue? And does that then make it more difficult to think about how it is we want to approach this other issue?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it has got very much tangled up, and that's because of how we've come to think about our borders post 9/11. You know, before 9/11, we didn't think much about the borders as a way to keep people out of the country. We mostly wanted people to come in. And, you know, we made, as I said, some efforts at the southern border to discourage illegal migration, but they weren't all that effective. Post 9/11, we've come to think of our borders really as the last line of defense, as the way in which we are going to keep people who mean to do us real harm out of the country. But the way in which we're doing that is to try, to whatever extent we possibly can, build up stronger and stronger border fortifications, both, you know, kind of literal fortifications like fences, and more virtual ones like more detailed background checks and watch lists and things like that. And when you do that, inevitably most of the people you're going to catch are not terrorists, because there aren't that many terrorists in the world. There are a small handful that we are and ought to be concerned about. Most of the people who are coming into the United States who would get caught up in these systems are illegal economic migrants of one form or another. So it's very hard to disentangle the two. I think there are ways you can do it, but after 9/11, they got hopelessly muddled.
Yeah. We've got a couple of calls here. We'll get to them right in a moment. But one other thing that I think is kind of interesting, just as an irony that you point out, when you're talking about the fact that one of the things that has happened since 9/11 as a result of our concerns about terrorism is that it has become more difficult for people who want to come to the United States, whether they want to come to work, they want to come to go to school, they just want to come on vacation and of course this depends on where it is they're coming from. But generally speaking, it's become more difficult for people to do that. That's the irony here is that President Bush, when he first came into office, really wanted to make it easier, particularly for economic migrants from the South, to come to the United States. He was, you know, he was interested in this in the relationship between the United States and Mexico, and came in right away proposing something that for a lot of people was actually kind of radical, and that was in effect creating a kind of a guest worker program so that if people wanted to come to work, we could make it possible for them to do that. And here now we have this administration that in fact, in the long run, has made it harder for people to come here. Mr. Bush started out talking about how he actually, for some people, wanted to make it easier for them to come here.
Yeah, this is not all at all the legacy that he wanted or anticipated. I mean, there are many tragedies in this administration and many ironies, but to my mind, this is one of the biggest that on border issues, his legacy has ended up being precisely the opposite of what he intended. I mean, it was a high priority for him from day one of his administration, and to try to come up with some arrangement with Mexico to make that border safer and easier for people to cross and for people to come to the United States who wanted to work here on some temporary basis. And the result has been really precisely the opposite.
The guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Edward Alden. He is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, former Washington bureau chief for the Financial Times, and is the author of the book, The Closing of the American Border, Terrorism, Immigration, and Security Since 9/11. It's published by Harper. And we have a couple of callers here. We start out with someone who's calling in from Oswego. That's on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hey, good morning. I just got back from California the day before yesterday, and I got to tell you, that place is a cesspool. And if somebody says the borders are closed and if they're doing border patrol and they're picking up on these illegals, they're wrong. Because when I was out there, where I was at, the desert, and where most of my family is, night after night, they were having raids, drugs, and 90% of the people they picked up were illegals, no documentation, no nothing. And it seems to be a round robin type thing. You know, they get caught, they get sent back, they, for some reason, end up back here again doing the same thing. The big issue is drugs. I mean, 90% of that, it was in the paper, I can name two papers right off the bat if people want to listen, read about them. Antelope Valley Press is one, and the other one is the LA Daily Herald. And it explains a lot what's going on instead of me just talking about it. The point I'm trying to make here is that Mexico has allowed this to go on. It's a known fact in California and other border states like Arizona and New Mexico and in Texas that the Mexican federales have been over there shooting at our guys. And, of course, the media, because they're so biased to who's in the office, doesn't report it. And it's a constant thing. Only the only people that find out about this are the locals that you get from the local papers. You know, if we're so worried about terrorism, how come we don't stop that? I don't understand it. It's just, and I don't want to sound like I'm picking on the illegals, so to speak, but it's open. Anybody can get through. We don't do anything about it, or the feds don't, and it's, you know, heaven forbid we get hit again.
Well, let me get a response, because this is also one of those things that you deal with, particularly the issue of if we really decided we were going to try, we were going to keep everybody out or do what we could to keep everybody out, the resources would have to be in hugely more than what there is by very significant magnitude. So that, you know, we may say that that's what we're trying to do, but the fact is that we're not doing it now, and who knows whether in fact we could do it.
Well, let's say, I mean, the reason that it's not done in the sense that you can always find places in the border where people are crossing is that it's tremendously difficult to do. I mean, just to throw out a few statistics, in the early 1990s, we had 2,000-3,000 Border Patrol agents for the whole country. We are now approaching 20,000. We've got unmanned aerial drones flying along that border. We've built about 400 miles of fencing. We are trying to create what they call virtual fence with surveillance cameras across a lot of the border. And as the caller rightly observes, people still come across, and they come across in lots of different places. Well, why is that? Part of the reason is that enforcement alone is never going to get you to where we need to be in terms of border control, because the tighter we squeeze there, the more lucrative it becomes for people to try to evade the controls. I mean, if you look, for instance, at the coyotes who smuggle illegal migrants across the southern border, you know, the cost of a trip has gone from, you know, from several hundred dollars in the late 90s to several thousand dollars now. So it's become much more lucrative. That money has allowed them to buy U.S. weapons, which are smuggled from the United States across the border into Mexico. So, you know, the caller talks about why the Mexicans don't do something about the problem on their side of the border. Well, we don't do anything about the problem on our side of the border, which is our weapons going down to arm the Mexican drug gangs and the Mexican smuggling gangs. So the fact is enforcement is important, but it's never going to be sufficient because you create a massive and well-financed organized crime problem on the other side of the border. And that's, you know, going back to President Bush, which you are soon to be ex-President Bush, which you mentioned, David. I mean, he understood this to some extent, which is why at the outset of his administration, he wanted to try to find a way to cooperate with the Mexicans on developing mechanisms to make that border work better. And one of the ways to do that was to provide new legal channels for people who wanted to come work here. So they wouldn't pay organized crime $3,000 to smuggle them across the border. So enforcement has real limitations, and I'm extremely sympathetic to people who say, yeah, the border is not closed in the South, because it's not. But enforcement alone is not going to get you there.
Well, just to ask a quick question then about the incoming administration, as during the campaign and up to this point, has Mr. Obama said anything in particular about how he would deal with this, and would, do you think, that this administration, the Obama administration, take a different approach than the Bush administration?
I expect the differences to be at the margins. I mean, Janet Napolitano, the Arizona governor who will be the next Secretary of Homeland Security, she had her confirmation hearing yesterday. She is a skeptic of physical measures like the fence, and I think that will get less priority in the new administration than it's had in this one. But she's enthusiastic about the high technology measures, the surveillance cameras and other things. I think, you know, she doesn't think about the problem in fundamentally different ways. I do think that the Obama administration would like to revive an immigration reform effort. There were bills in before the Congress in 2006 and 2007 that would have created new legal ways, particularly for lower skilled workers to come from Mexico to the United States. But you have to think, with all of the things on his plate and with an economy in which unemployment is almost certain to reach 8-9%, perhaps 10%, that the likelihood of immigration reform, particularly immigration reform which makes it easier for people to come here, is a pretty heavy lift. They say they'll do immigration reform, but I've heard no mention of what the timing might be.
All right, let's talk with another caller. In Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yes. I say the only way that you're going to stop a lot of people from coming over here is the people that's hiring them, the people that's giving them jobs. And another thing, the reason why you're having a lot of problems on the border and things like that in Mexico, because you have these people in the United States that's selling these people weapons. They don't care who they sell them to as long as they get them money. And anyway, immigration and things is not going to be the first thing on Barack Obama's plate. He got the economy to deal with. He got the Middle East to deal with. He got a lot of things to deal with. That will come up and things like that. But as I say, it takes the people in the United States to work together and help our country out. Report these people that's hiring these illegals. The new ones that come in, catch them and send them back. The people that's been here for years and things, let them eventually come citizens. You know, I mean, you know, we got to work right with these people and things. I mean, I feel when people start talking about the Mexicans and things, it sort of bring back to me like how they used to do us in Mississippi. My parents and my grandparents, great grandparents back there, they treated you like you was nothing, you know. Mm. But it's gonna take all of us to cooperate, stop selling these people these guns until you find out what they're going to do with them and things like that. It's greed, 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 greed. Hiring people so you don't have to pay them the wages that you pay Americans, paying them under the table, you know.
Yeah. I appreciate the comments, the call, and I'm interested in Mr. Alden, what you would have to say. You can respond to any of that, but particularly, I guess I'm interested in the point the caller makes about people who would hire individuals who are undocumented. And it seems to me at various points that people have said, well, the way to deal with the issue of people who are here illegally is to really put the burden on employers or potential employers to make sure for them, it's on them to determine whether the person is legal or not. And then, on the other hand, I think people have argued that that's too much of a burden for employers, particularly small business people, and that it shouldn't be their responsibility. I mean, how do we sort all that out?
Well, I think the caller actually laid out a very nice set of arguments for the type of immigration reform that we've been discussing in this country the past few years. Let me deal specifically with the employer sanctions question, because it's crucial. If you go back to the last time we tried seriously to deal with this problem, which was in 1986, it was supposed to be the legislation that was passed at the time, known as IRCA, or the Immigration Reform and Control Act, was supposed to do two things. One, it was going to legalize most of the people who were living here illegally on the grounds that, you know, in various ways we tacitly encouraged them to come. You know, there were jobs for them and we didn't try very hard to keep them out. And so in various ways we were complicit in their being here and it was going to be hard to send them home. And so we do a legalization, which is the same argument you've heard this time around. The second component of that was supposed to be tough sanctions against employers to dry up the future flow. We would try to make sure that there weren't jobs for undocumented migrants in the future. Well, the second part of that never happened. The Reagan administration was loath to put that sort of regulatory burden on employers. The money never came from Congress for enforcement. And so employer sanctions, by and large, were never implemented. It became very easy for people to get jobs using poor copied Social Security cards or using somebody else's Social Security number. I think a critical part of what we're going to see going forward, and if there's another immigration reform, is a serious effort this time to stop employers from hiring undocumented migrants. One of the things you have now that you didn't have back then is the technology. I mean, we've got a system now that's referred to as E-Verify, which is pretty easy for employers, you know, using a computer hookup with the Department of Homeland Security to verify whether the person sitting there for the job interview is authorized to work in the United States or not. It still has glitches. Employers don't like it very much. There's scope for improvement, but it's a lot better than anything we had 20 years ago. You know, this is not going to dry up all employment opportunities for illegal migrants. I mean, we all know that there's a lot of underground work that goes on in the economy, in construction or people doing domestic services or one sort or another. But if you could get legitimate employers out of this business, that would go a long way to drying up the demand and trying to see that we don't just do a repeat of the 1986 legislation.
All right. Again, we'll go to another caller. This is also someone in Urbana in line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
My daughter lives in Bisbee, Arizona, a mile from the border, and they have built, near her house, along the border, they built 3 miles of fencing to the cost of $30 million. And so she tells me that the Mexicans still get through, that they make some kind of homemade ladders to climb across, up and across the fence to get in. And so I guess I don't think fences really work. And another, and one experience she had with illegal immigrants was a couple came to her door and demanded that she drive them to Tucson, which is 100 miles. And she wouldn't stop demanding this, and so my daughter finally said, well, if you don't leave, I'm going to call the police. So I just thought that this is something that I learned firsthand, and I just thought I'd contribute it to the conversation.
All right. Well, again, Mr. Alden, you can react to that any way you like.
Yeah, no, I am. I mean, very good observation. Janet Napolitano, who will be our next Secretary of Homeland Security, has been quoted as saying, if you build a 12-foot-high fence, illegal migrants will use a 13-foot-high ladder. And there's a lot of truth to that. I mean, I don't think it's physically impossible to build a barrier that people can't get over or around. I mean, look at the Berlin Wall, right? If you're willing to build, a multi-layer fortified fence and have, armed people posted every 400 yards along it, you could conceivably keep people from getting across, but nobody's talking about going to that length. So we build fences that people can actually dig under or climb over or otherwise get around. The story of what goes on there along the border, I think for the people in the border regions there, it's a very bad situation and getting worse because the criminal problem on the Mexican side of the border is getting worse. The level of violence there is truly horrific. I mean, one of the people I write about in my book was, it's a long story and I won't tell it. I'll encourage people to read the book, but he was a Lebanese man who got caught out by one of these post 9/11 schemes. Innocent guy who got charged for technical violation. He'd been married to a Mexican American woman. He's now living in Laredo. Nuevo Laredo, just on the Mexican side of the border, and he said it's worse than when he lived in Beirut during the Civil War. These are very, very dangerous places, and this is spilling over to the American side. And it gets back to my previous point, is that enforcement alone is not going to do this. We have to find ways to cooperate with the Mexican government to take the criminal element out of this, to remove some of the profitability from trafficking people and drugs across the border, or we're never going to get a handle on this problem.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Edward Alden. He's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He is also the former Washington bureau chief for the Financial Times. He's the author of the book, The Closing of the American Border, Terrorism, Immigration, and Security Since 9/11. It's published by Harper. Questions welcome, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. I wanted to get us back to the focus on terrorism. Right after 9/11, one of the big concerns, maybe the major concern of the government was the question, were there other people already in the United States, people who were in place, ready to go, planning on and just very quietly sitting there waiting to commit some act of terrorism? That would be one issue. They were trying to ask that question, are there more people like the hijackers who were already here? And then another issue, obviously, would be if there were people who are outside the United States who wanted to come here to do that, you'll want to get that person before they get into the United States. So then the question is, well, though, was using immigration, was saying, well, what we're going to do is here, we're going to try to find out everybody who is here illegally and in a sense almost make the assumption from the get-go that they're up to no good. Was it inevitable that that was the way that they decided to go about trying to answer that big question, are there people here who are just waiting to do something like this?
Well, I don't think it was inevitable, but it wasn't surprising given the limitations on what we knew. I mean, on the night of 9/11, what would you want to know? You would want to have sources in communities around the United States, particularly Muslim and Arab communities, because that's obviously where, this particular threat comes from. You'd want to have sources that you could go to and could say, well, there are people here in Detroit or there are people here in New Jersey that we've actually been concerned about, and real information that might point you to whether there were further terrorist cells in the United States that were preparing follow-on attacks. But we didn't have any of that kind of information. The FBI did not have good sources in these communities. We had no real intelligence. And so what happened was the Justice Department decided to use very crude tools. And it fanned out into these communities, and on a variety of tips, or not even tips, just people standing in the wrong place at the wrong time, began to arrest and hold Muslims and Arabs who were living here in the country on temporary visas of some sort or another. And in a lot of cases, they were able to find minor immigration violations and to hold these people for long periods of time. And you know, this is a set of events that I just do not think has ever got the attention it's deserved here. I mean, we have been outraged by Guantanamo. We have been outraged by the CIA secret prisons and by waterboarding. What happened here in this country after 9/11 was the Justice Department, the FBI, arrested something like 1,000 people. And close to 800 of those were held for months and months in prison, particularly in New York. No charges ever laid against them. Their treatment was brutal. This has all been documented by the Justice Department Inspector General. These people were beaten. These people were left in freezing cold cells with no clothes. In the summer, the heat was turned on, and they were sweltering in their cells. They were kept in isolation for long periods of time, lights burning 24 hours a day. Brutal, brutal treatment. And not one of these people who were arrested and held for various minor immigration violations was ever shown to have a connection with terrorism. Mm. So, I mean, you can understand why it was done. In the absence of real information, you use the tool you have, which is, well, if we can find people who've committed some immigration violation, we can hold them, and we can keep them in jail while we question them. But the way in which it was carried out was really a blight, I think, on our country that has never got the attention that it deserved.
Did it, and if we're talking about people who had broken the law, maybe it was minor, but they had somehow violated immigration law, did most of those people end up being deported, or did eventually that get resolved in some fashion so that they were able to get back to something like the life that they had before in the United States?
No, most of them were deported. Mm-hmm. The vast majority of them were, in fact, deported.
And maybe one other quick point, and we have some other calls, but one other quick point when we talk about what we have done since in terms of regulating who can come to the United States, that we have continued to be so fixated on the profile of the 9/11 hijackers that for those people who want to come here to the United States, if they are male and if they are coming from a country where the population is predominantly Muslim, we've made it extremely difficult for them to come into the country, so that today, if you want to come from Ireland, or you want to come from Canada, or you want to come from Japan, that's one thing. But if you want to come from Pakistan, that's something else.
Yeah, no. If you look at the numbers, I mean, travel from all parts of the world to the United States went down after 9/11, particularly from anywhere where you needed to get a visa, which included China and India and other places, because it became very hard for a couple of years to get a visa from anywhere. Since then, we really have improved the systems significantly. But the place, you know, the one place in the world where you know people are coming at sort of half the rate they used to before 9/11 are these countries, you know, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Pakistan, Jordan, Middle East. And you could say, well, good thing, you know, these are people who might be a threat to us. We don't want them to come here. But the fact is, the war on terrorism is a two-faceted war. On the one hand, obviously, you want to prevent another attack, and you want to be able to identify and keep out people who threaten you. But over the long haul, this is an ideological struggle, and we want to persuade people that our vision of the world is a better vision than the vision of Al-Qaeda terrorists. And a lot of our best allies are people in these countries who come and see the United States. They see it for themselves. They become our best friends around the world. We're making it impossible for them to come here anymore. And I think in the longer run, we do a lot of damage to our image and standing in the world by making it so difficult for those people to travel here.
Yeah, and you would also, I'm sure, make the additional argument that we are also losing whatever those people who would come here to this country would contribute to this country, our culture, our economy.
All those things, absolutely.
Yeah. Other callers here. We'll go next to someone in Sullivan on our line 4. Hello.
Yeah, I got two statements. I think, you know, we are the terrorists of the world. I mean, if you don't believe our ways, we'll bomb the hell out of you. So I don't blame the people in a way. I don't condone it, don't get me wrong, but, you know, why should they sit there and be blown away by us when they don't respond? You know, that's one side. And then on the other side, well, the people coming from Mexico and whatever, I'm in a business and I can't get any American person to work. because they're either on welfare, having kids or something like that, or somebody's taking care of them. There's nobody in this country that will work the Mexican type of work for their pay.
Well, I don't know how if you want to respond to.
I would disassociate myself from the first statement. I mean, you know, Bin Laden may have had certain legitimate beefs with the Saudi government and others, but there was nothing that justified what happened on 9/11. That is an act of grim and senseless violence by any measure. On the second part, I mean, this is one of the debates that's ongoing, and the evidence on it is incomplete. You know, the argument is that there are a lot of jobs that Americans won't do, and that is why we need to bring in lower skilled, largely uneducated, less than high school education workers from Mexico and Central America. I think, you know, if you look around, I think there's a lot of truth to that. I think, you know, particularly in agriculture, in some sectors of the tourist industry and others, it's very, very hard to find Americans to do this kind of work. What we don't know is if the wages went up sufficiently, would that work become more attractive? And so this is one of the dilemmas, right? To the extent that employers can hire cheaper workers coming in from Mexico or elsewhere, they don't have to raise their wages. Would they be able to stay in business at the higher wages they would have to pay Americans to attract them to that kind of work? It's hard to say. You know, some maybe would if everybody else was forced to pay the higher wages. Others would probably go out of business. So it's a difficult question that is very much at the heart of a lot of these debates.
All right. Let's go to line one for another caller. Urbana, hello.
Hi. This is a good discussion. I am agreeable to having Mexicans work here in this country. There's nothing wrong with that. You know, I think they need if they need to make money just like anyone else. But their being legal is the issue, I think, and it's making a strain on this country in a lot of areas by having them here illegally. I heard, though, that in Indiana they have made a law where illegals have to have a driver's license, a legal driver's license. If they don't, then they're not able to drive. And by them making that law, they catch a lot of illegals that way. And a lot of them are going back to their country because they can't get work without getting where they have to go, and they have to have this ID, the state driver's license ID, in order to get to work. Wouldn't that be a good way of keeping track of the aliens in this country? And I'll hang up. You can.
Oh, all right.
Well, there is, you know, there are a couple of issues raised here. There is a big effort now at the impetus of the federal government to force the states to begin issuing what are known as secure driver's licenses. And this is another one of the areas where we've seen the conflation of terrorism concerns and immigration concerns. I mean, what started this was the fact that the hijackers used driver's licenses as their identification to board airplanes. And so there are legitimate concerns from a terrorism perspective that you don't want to give driver's licenses to people, which are, after all, our primary form of identification, unless you actually know that they're in the country properly and you know a little bit about them. You know that criminal background checks have been run and that you know, these are people that we want to be holding driver's licenses. And so the federal government has been pressing the states under what's known as the Real ID Law to adopt these secure driver's licenses. And most of the states are gradually going along, but there's a lot of complaints because it's a very expensive program for the states, and most of the states are facing massive budget shortfalls as it is. The question gets raised, you know, what then do you do with illegal immigrants? Do you want to deny them driver's licenses? Well, the argument that a lot of police departments make is, well, no, you really don't, because then they're going to drive without licenses. And it's better off if we know who they are, we know that they've registered with us, and we know that they've passed a driver's test, so that they're not out there on the road endangering other people. But that's not a popular argument. You remember Hillary Clinton in the debates got caught out by expressing some support for illegal immigrants being given driver's licenses and had to run away from that position very rapidly. As a tool to try to encourage people to leave, I think it's probably not a very effective one. You know, look, if you're willing to live in this country and have a phony Social Security card and live the kind of shadow existence that illegal migrants live, whether you have a driver's license or not, it's probably not the biggest factor, right? If you're already living here illegally, you're probably going to drive illegally if you need to do so in order to maintain your work. A far more potent factor in encouraging people to return is the state of the economy right now. And even there, you know, the evidence is still a bit mixed. I think, you know, the best evidence out there is that the number of people living illegally in the United States is starting to decline. And that's because the work is drying up. It dried up first in construction, which is a sector that has employed a lot of undocumented migrants. So that's the powerful force, not denying people driver's licenses.
When the subject of illegal immigration comes up, it seems that the main focus here, the major focus, is on people who sneak into the country. There are apparently significant numbers of people, though, who actually came here legally. They had permission to come in and had a visa and simply overstayed. And it seems that in the past, one of the problems that we've had is keeping track of people like that. Are we doing any better with that now?
Well, we're starting to, but it's tremendously hard, and you have to ask yourself about the costs. You know, the number that gets thrown about, and I'm not sure how credible a figure this is, but the number that gets thrown about is that something in the neighborhood of 40% of the illegal migrants living here right now are people who came on legal visas, you know, as students or travelers. They claim they were going to Disney World, and they just stayed. They didn't go back home. Well, we have, you know, the United States is in the process of developing a system to try to track this. We've put in place some of the first part of it, which is if you're a visitor in the United States right now, you have to give fingerprints when you arrive at the airport. You give 10 fingerprints and we run a series of checks on you, and you've in effect checked into the country. We are in the process of trying to develop a checkout system. Washington has told the airlines that starting probably sometime this year, when people check in for their flight out of the country, they're going to have to give a fingerprint at the airline counter, and that will be matched up with a fingerprint they gave when they arrived, and so we will know that they left before their visa expired. The airlines, of course, hate this idea because they have been trying to develop ways to speed people through the check-in procedure. You know, a lot of times now when you go for your flight, you do that automatic check-in. You don't even deal with an agent. So they have no idea how they're going to develop the physical infrastructure to take fingerprints from people when they're leaving the country. But this is what they've been asked to do by the government. And that will begin to give you some kind of number on how many people are overstaying. But, of course, that's only the first part of it. What about the land borders? You know, somebody could fly in and then, you know, leave across the border to Canada, and we'd never know. So Congress has mandated, and again, we're trying to develop it, but at God knows what cost, a system that would actually allow you to do the same thing at the land borders. But the logistical difficulties of that are tremendous. You know, there are millions of people crossing those land borders on a daily basis. Very, very difficult to keep track of those kind of numbers.
Well, that just, again, a quick question about that. One of the changes that has gone into effect recently is that now it used to be quite easy to go back and forth. I've had some experience going back and forth from here into Canada.
Yeah.
And it used to be really quite easy. Well, now you're going to have to have, I guess there are some varieties of secure identification, but one of the things, for example, that you might have to have, if you go into Canada for vacation, you come back to the United States, you're going to have a passport, which you never had to have before, and there was a lot of concern about, you know, how much more difficult that it would be to make the crossing, and, you know, how much would it cost, and what people would have to go through to have a passport, and what that would mean for the economy, maybe of both countries, for people who just, you know, want to drive across and spend some money and come back. How has all that gone?
Well, we're still in the middle of it. You're correct that very soon you are going to be required to have one of a limited number of accepted forms of identification across the border, a passport, what they call a Nexus card, which is a sort of preferred crossing card. And in some places, like Washington State, where they've developed these secure driver's licenses, those will be acceptable. So there'll be a limited number of forms of ID that can be used. As of this June, that system is supposed to be fully implemented. They've been gradually implementing it. Congress has pushed back the deadlines a couple of times, but it looks like it will be a fact as of June. So you'll need that kind of identification now. An awful lot of Americans don't have passports. You know, the numbers are something like 15%, and a lot of people on those northern border communities have been used to traveling back and forth without having to have that sort of identity. It's expensive to get a passport. There's a cost associated with getting these Nexus cards. So the fear is, and I think it's a reasonable one, that a lot of the easy casual travel back and forth across the border, you know, the guy who drives from, you know, Windsor into Detroit to watch a Red Wings game and then, you know, goes back across the border, that kind of travel will slow down after these requirements are implemented, and that there'll be a cost to businesses and others in the border regions. So that's still it's still in progress, and we're going to see the full impact of it probably sometime this year.
All right, we get a couple more calls in here in the time that remains. Effingham is next, line two. Hello.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Your guest seems to be making great pronouncements about symptoms, and the term sneak or illegal occurs after the fact. The thing we have to understand is, why do people immigrate, and why do they not stay in their nation of origin? And the financial system that we now live in and under and suffer from has now circled the earth, and there is no place to go. There is, if I were a Mexican national and I had children and I had no meaningful work, and I were victimized by the very system supposed to protect me, and then be harassed and killed by a criminal element who doesn't have to immigrate because they live off of those who do work. And to somehow think that the system is not culpable in the whole conversation that has gone on today, I never heard or had any knowledge of, read, where an African black who was sold by his peers in Africa to sail to America in chains, which is almost unbelievable, you know, with the present conversation that's going on and around this world. You know, I think maybe the symptoms of these of what we're discussing here this morning should be addressed and reveal its role in the whole process and the ungluing of civil society as we know it now. I mean, the fellow from Sullivan had a point, because it's too late when the bombs are dropping on your head. No matter who dropped them there, the person receiving them, then the first thing that pops in your head is terrorism. So I'll hang up and listen off the air.
The caller raises fine questions. I think they're beyond the scope of this conversation that we're trying to have here this morning. I don't know.
It's a pretty big list. I'll just comment on one, which is the language. Okay. And I'll accept the caller's point that the terms illegal or you know, they're difficult and contentious ones. And when we look at our history, the notion of an illegal migrant is a fairly modern notion, right? You know, the people who arrived at Ellis Island, right, which were, you know, a vast, you know, majority of you know, the ancestors, a lot of people who live here now, if they arrived in the United States, they were allowed in almost all cases, right? They needed to get on a boat and get here. And once they got here, that was fine. We would allow them in. I mean, my ancestors were the first Europeans to come to the United States, came on the Mayflower. And, you know, nobody invited them, but once they were here and they established themselves, they stayed. And then, you know, along the southern border for years, people moved back and forth across the border freely with no documentation at all. A lot of these categories are very modern ones, you know, because we live in a big crowded world in which we can't allow everybody who wants to come to the country to come, and so we have to try to find some way to regulate that. But it's important to remember that this is a fairly modern, recent development. You know, in the history of the United States, we, for the most part, let whoever wanted to come here and stay.
We're to the point here where we're going to have to finish, and not surprisingly, the conversation really has drifted. People have taken it to the issue of illegal immigration in the southern border. Maybe just to give you a chance to talk for about a minute, one of the other things that you talk about in the book is, you know, not only in the way we think about immigration is it obviously an important issue, is how do we keep out people we don't want. There's another one here that we really haven't talked about, and that is, what do we do to try to encourage people that we do want to be able to come here and make it you know, is relatively easy for people to come to the United States and bring with them their hard work and their skills and their interest in becoming an American and contributing to the country.
Well, I think, you know, if you look particularly at our recent history, immigrants have been an absolutely vital part of making America the innovative, successful economy that it has been and will be again after we climb out of this current recession. A very high percentage of our top scientists, engineers, are people who come here to study in American universities because we have the best universities in the world and we attract the best students from all around the world. A lot of them come and they want to stay and they become part of our companies, they become scientists, they become engineers. This is absolutely critical to our long-term prosperity. And one of the things that's happened post 9/11 that I think is a very bad thing in terms of our future is that more and more of these students are going elsewhere. They're going to Britain, they're going to Canada, they're going even to Japan, which is not a place that historically welcomed them, because it's become more difficult for them to come here. And we will pay a price for that. And we have to be very careful that in trying to secure ourselves in the short term, we don't undermine the economic foundations of our country for the longer term, and I worry that that's what we're doing.
All right. Well, we're going to have to stop. Certainly, if people are interested in reading more on the subject, the book to look at is The Closing of the American Border, Terrorism, Immigration, and Security Since 9/11. It's published by Harper, by our guest Edward Alden. He is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and former Washington Bureau Chief for the Financial Times. Mr. Alden, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me on the show, Dave. Appreciate it.